What do politics and professional sports have in common? More than you might think, especially this year. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the 2nd of November, Monday. Great as always to have you with us, everybody. We begin today with a story you might look at from any one of a number of angles. It's a story of collective bargaining. It's a story of content once again being king. And it's a story of seizing one's moment while one can. Republican presidential hopefuls, as I'm sure you've heard by now, are really, really unhappy about the last debate. So unhappy, in fact, that they have drawn up a common list of demands for future televised matchups. Common, that is, except for Donald Trump, who has now apparently decided to negotiate directly with the networks on his own. These kinds of talks between networks and candidates happen every election cycle. Length, location, date, sit or stand, temperature of the room, that kind of stuff. This year, though, with primary debates smashing ratings and revenue records, Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports from New York that the candidates are taking a page from the professional sports playbook.
There's a common thread between Senator Marco Rubio's big score at the CNBC debate.
The only reason why you're doing it now is because we're running for the same position and someone has convinced you that attacking me is going to help you.
Well,
here's the bottom line. I'm not.
And this touchdown for Rubio's beloved Miami Dolphins. Nearly all of viewers saw these moments as they happened. Laura Martin is senior analyst at Needham & Company.
The debates, you have to watch them live, which means you sit through all the commercial breaks.
That's a rare thing in the age of DVRs, which means networks can charge premium ad prices. Now, the candidates have figured out what the NFL and other sports leagues have known for a long time. If you control content people will watch live, you can drive a hard bargain with networks. 14 million people watched the debate live on CNBC, more than quadrupling the audience of their debate 4 years ago. Kenneth Shropshire, director of the Wharton School's Sports Business Initiative, says campaigns are fighting harder now.
So it is something new in terms of the level of power that's being exercised.
But just like in government, politicians have to be wary of the limits of their power.
I think that the candidates potentially overestimate the leverage they have.
John Swallen of Kantar Media tracks the ad market.
The commercial load here is 30-40% of what normal programming on these networks has. Even with the higher than normal advertising rates, they're not bringing in windfall amounts of advertising revenue.
And unlike pro sports, the presidential race only comes around every 4 years. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
In other news of theater, the actual kind this time, not the political, the final installment of the Hunger Games movie franchise comes out later this month. But Katniss Everdeen fans take heart, the trilogy-turned-film empire will live on in theme parks. Lionsgate Entertainment said today it's developing rides and other attractions based on the Hunger Games and some other films in its portfolio. But Marketplace's Amy Scott reports you can't always just order up a Hollywood ending in the theme park business, you know.
If you're familiar with the Hunger Games books or movies, you know they're about children forced to fight each other to the death. How that translates to, say, a roller coaster?
I think it would be quite challenging.
Phil Hedema runs a company that designs themed attractions. He worked for Disney and Universal Studios for years. Hedema says the challenge in bringing any story to life...
You need to check the boxes of all of the things that people are most familiar with in that franchise.
Leave something out and fans could be disappointed. Fortunately, Hedema says there are plenty of family-friendly themes in the Hunger Games stories, like loyalty and skill.
The killing the children box could remain unchecked.
Movie studios are clamoring to cash in on their intellectual property around the world. There's a Warner Brothers park in Spain with a Superman roller coaster. 20th Century Fox has a new one in Malaysia. Lionsgate is partnering with theme parks in Dubai and outside Atlanta, also an immersive entertainment center near Macau. Parks themselves bring in billions of dollars in revenue worldwide. But David Cobb with the design firm Thinkwell Group says there's a bigger payoff.
Positive word of mouth, knowing that the brand lives on beyond the movies that you saw. There's all sorts of reasons for brands to sort of look at the real world as a place for these heretofore ephemeral brands to sort of live.
That is, if the attractions are done well, says Bob Rogers with BRC Imagination Arts.
A lot of the studios, at least on their first pass, just think that by licensing their name and their logo and their characters, that causes an attraction. It doesn't.
Just because you have the characters, he says, doesn't mean you have the ride. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
That might be the best quote ever on this program. The killing the children box will go unchecked. All right, November started pretty well down in Lower Manhattan. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Story now from the Marketplace desk of the fine print is there for a reason, you know, specifically a phrase in a lot of the contracts that consumers sign to get cell phones or credit cards or almost anything these days, really, a requirement that those consumers give up their rights to trials, you know, in court and everything, in favor of individual arbitration. It sounds simple enough. According to a series of articles in the New York Times, though, it is anything but. Jessica Silver Greenberg shared the byline. Jessica, thanks for coming on.
Good to be here.
We have all signed these contracts, right? I mean, you have, I have. It's not like they're new.
That's right. These contracts that include arbitration clauses are in virtually everything we sign. It's almost impossible to wake up and go through your day without colliding with one. So they're definitely not new. Tens of millions of Americans sign them.
Let me play average American consumer for a second.
I go to
sign up for whatever it is that, you know, whatever company includes one of these clauses in its contract. I see it and I say to myself, oh, I'm going to sign it because I want this phone or I want this service. And really, what's the worst that could happen? I mean, come on, right?
Right. You're like Patricia Rowe, the chiropractor in our story. Mm-hmm. She saw this $600 cancellation fee. She starts asking around. She ends up realizing that people in three different states are complaining about this charge. So then you find a lawyer, and if they're a smart lawyer, they'll look at your contract first, and they'll probably turn you down.
Right, because they know what you've signed.
Yeah. Exactly. So you're kind of just out of luck.
And you go on about your business and you're disgruntled against corporate America forever, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
But then there are worse examples, right? I mean, you know, let's say you check your loved one into a nursing home.
Yeah.
And you think that that nursing home has been negligent, or your loved one dies, or they're abused, or in one case that we looked at, sexually assaulted twice in 2 days by two separate residents. And you want to bring a case and you sue. Let's say you get that far and the nursing home says, sorry, look at this arbitration clause that you signed. And then you don't have the benefit of a jury. You don't have the benefit of a judge. You're taking that to a private proceeding. And I think many of the regulators that we spoke to, one of the things that is most irksome, worrisome for them is that those proceedings are private.
The response by the companies, of course, I imagine there are two, one that's said and one that's not, right? The one that's said is, you know what, arbitration gives people a chance to settle things at low cost and lets them have access to the system. And so there's that one. But the other one is, you know what, if you don't want Netflix, if you don't want this AT&T contract, don't sign it.
Right. We heard that throughout the reporting is, you know, who needs a class action when you can easily get your dispute resolved through arbitration? Well, when you look at the data, it just doesn't bear out. So between 2010 and 2014, 500 people, a little more than 500 people, went to arbitration for a dispute of $2,500 or less. Mm-hmm. So if you think about tens of millions of people being covered by these clauses and only that small fraction going to arbitration, you're probably, if you can't form together as a class, you're just going to give up. The second point is, you know, yes, you could say, I object to this idea. I'm not going to get a cell phone. I mean, when it comes to cell phones, 99% of cell phone providers include this. So if you want to be a Luddite, sure, you don't have to sign a clause. But for the most part, these are things that we rely on for our daily lives.
The piece is on arbitration in the New York Times, our co-byline by Jessica Silver Greenberg. Jessica, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
If you're a dedicated reader of nutritional labels on food packaging, you've probably more than once pondered this question. What exactly is the difference between high fructose corn syrup and sugar? Luckily for you, there is the American judicial system. Tomorrow, in a federal courtroom here in Los Angeles, that very question will be on the docket. Producers and refiners of cane sugar and sugar beets are suing the Corn Refiners Association and some of its members, including Cargill and Archer Daniels Midland, over their claims that high fructose corn syrup is more or less like table sugar. Marketplace's Annie Baxter looks at why things have gotten so sour in the sweetener business.
In the 1960s, scientists developed the enzymes to make a new kind of sweetener out of this. That would be corn shooting into a storage bin on a Midwestern farm. Take that corn, do some processing to it that includes the use of enzymes, and you get high fructose corn syrup. It took off as a sweetener in the 80s and 90s. It was cheap and more shelf-stable than sugar, and it made its way into gobs of food products, like soft drinks,
Coca-Cola,
bread,
Eat Wonder Bread,
and condiments.
Ketchup, ketchup.
But then something changed.
What happened is that myths started to arise.
That's Dan Webb, a lawyer. In the early 2000s, things kind of started to go south for his clients, the corn refiners. Consumption of their high fructose corn syrup began falling.
People misunderstood the product and believed that it actually could somehow be worse for you in a way that somehow sugar was not.
One allegation that cropped up online and elsewhere was that high fructose corn syrup was somehow unnatural because it's processed. Though technically, table sugar is processed too.
Sugar and high fructose corn syrup are not picked off of a vine or a tree and put into your mouth.
Another problem was the name. Fructose is a sugar that taxes the liver when consumed in excess. So the words high fructose don't sound great. But the sweetener is only named that way to differentiate from plain old corn syrup, which it's made from. High fructose corn syrup actually has about as much fructose as table sugar. The corn refiners pumped millions of dollars into a marketing campaign to clear this up. And they tried, unsuccessfully, to change their product's name to the nicer sounding corn sugar.
That effort included what we believe to have been a deliberate campaign at false advertising. A claim that high fructose corn syrup was the same as common table sugar.
Mark Lanier is a lawyer for the sugar side. His group has tried to connect high fructose corn syrup to obesity, which is part of why the corn refiners are countersuing.
There are a number of studies that show that high fructose corn syrup has a more toxic effect on the body.
And there are also a number of scientists who say that's not true. The American Medical Association's policy recommends further study, but says there's currently not enough evidence that people should specifically restrict use of the sweetener. Marion Nessel, a nutrition expert at New York University, doubts it's exceptionally bad.
Consumers think that high fructose corn syrup is poison. It's not. It's just like sugar, except it's in liquid form.
Nessel is known for her scathing critiques of the food industry. She says she's really no fan of either sweetener.
Everybody consumes too much of both and would be healthier eating less.
Still, a lot of Americans seem to think sugar is more virtuous. Darren Seifer is the food and beverage industry analyst at the NPD Group, a research firm.
I wouldn't be able to answer how this might play out in a court of law, but yeah, in the court of public opinion, it looks like sugars might have won already.
A number of big food manufacturers are now dropping high fructose corn syrup from some of their products and using sugar instead. In St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Coming up,
you know, the consumers love television, and I know this is heretical to say this, but they love it a little bit less because there's too much of it.
Too much of a good thing? I don't know. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 165 points today, 0.9%, finished at 17,828. Did the blue chips. The NASDAQ jumped 73 points, 1.4%, 5127. The S&P 500 gained 24 points, 1.2%, 2104. The Hewlett-Packard Company, the computer and printer maker known as HP, is now officially HP Inc. That's after the company split off its data, software, and services side. Think the cloud. That is now the Hewlett-Packard Enterprise Company. Upon the split up, shares of HP Inc., ticker symbol HPQ, the way it used to be, clicked up 13%. Shares of Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, that is HPE, down 1.5%. Bond prices fell today. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.17%. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, look, I've got good news and I've got some bad news. The bad news is that the infrastructure in the Mississippi River Basin, the locks and the dams and the ports on America's biggest waterway, are just this side of failing. America's Watershed Initiative, that's a group that supports the Mississippi watershed, gave it a D+. The good news is that that's a great excuse to get Austin Golding back on the air. He runs his family's barge company. It's Golding Barge Lines. They are out of Vicksburg, Mississippi. It's good to have you back on.
Thanks for having me.
What does it mean for you in terms of doing your business when infrastructure is bad? Are there locks and rivers and dams and all that stuff that you have to negotiate that sort of impede your progress?
Absolutely. I think probably the biggest hurdle for us is the lock and dam issue. Our harbors and our ports need attention also, but without the locks and dams, we're seeing massive delay in the Ohio Valley and soon to be at Industrial Lock in New Orleans. The good thing about it is that we have seen a 3-year trend line and an upswing in funding that's resulted in a shorter timeline for projects that we're kind of targeting right now. So not only are we starting to invest more in our infrastructure, the projects are starting to become more efficient in their production, and it's putting a lot of people to work.
Talk to me for a second about delay. If you get stuck in a lock and dam system wherever, up and down the river, for, I don't know, an extra, 6 hours? What does that mean for you?
If I got to a lock and I only had to wait 6 hours right now, I would be excited.
Oh, okay.
I'm seeing sometimes as much as 2 to 3 days delay.
Wow. Wow.
At some of these facilities, especially during harvest season, during the fall and late summer, when a lot of, 60% of all of our grain exports in this country come through the waterways,
mm-hmm.
and 25% of our petroleum products in this country do also. So it gets awfully busy out there, and 6 hours would be a welcome time frame in what we're dealing with right now.
When your captains come back, because we've talked before about how you have to spend most of your time in the office, but when your barge captains, or whatever you call them, come back, what are they saying about what it's like out there?
Well, I think that you're seeing the vessels and the actual tools of the trade have really improved from a safety and navigation standpoint, but the infrastructure just has not kept up. And that's frustrating because these mariners are really more skilled than they've ever been. The boats are more efficient than they've ever been. The barges are safer than they've ever been. And we're watching emerging economies like India, like Brazil, like China really start to invest heavily within their waterways infrastructure system. And this country seems to just take it for granted. And I think that's going to be a mistake if we don't try to keep up with the rest of the world.
So you transport still mostly bulk petroleum products, right?
Yes, sir. All petroleum products.
So let me ask you this. Do you care what the market price of those products is? I mean, oil is down, gas is down, or are you just hauling it from point to point and you get your percentage, whatever it is?
Well, it does impact us in the trading side of our business. So we've seen the trading sector of our business really slow down. But if you're a refiner and gas is cheaper than ever, there's a good chance you're selling more gas than you ever have. So we've been pretty busy on that side.
Yeah, so volume's up, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Austin Golding, he runs Golding Barge Lines down in Vicksburg, Mississippi. Mr. Golding, good to talk to you again, sir.
Hey, thank you, Kai. All the best.
If you watch shows like The Americans or It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia or Louie, John Landgraf is the guy to thank. Well, Landgraf and his creative team, he is the CEO of FX Networks. And this summer at a big Television Critics Association meeting, he did something unusual for a TV executive. He said there is too much television out there. So many shows that audiences are overwhelmed and missing out on the really great stuff. And that, in fact, there is a television content bubble. If ever there was a business model conundrum, that's it. So we called him up to talk about it. John Landgraf, welcome to the program.
Happy to be here.
How do you know, or why do you say, I guess is a better question, why do you say there's a content bubble now in television?
Well, I can't prove it. I can tell you that I went, as someone who does this professionally, from being able to keep track of every show, you know, and know what the show was about and know something about who was making it, is it good or bad, to absolutely not being able to keep track of every show. Couldn't tell you if you put me in a room. I could probably name half those shows by title. Hmm. You know, what ends up happening then is you have more difficulty having a coherent dialogue on a national basis about what television shows were great, what television shows were important, which ones were addressing issues or introducing us to characters we'd never seen before. That seems to have kind of fractured and broken down to a large extent at the moment.
Yeah, but why can't you, I guess, as a programmer, simply trust consumers to find what is out there? Because we know what we like. I mean, we're fickle, yes, but once we find something good, we stick with it.
I don't think that you're the consumer in this sentence, can uh-huh. find what you like best. I think that you can find things that you like because there's so much good television that you're never going to run out of a supply. But if your goal was to find the things that you would like best, I think you'll have limited amount of success because I think you have no way of navigating and really finding you know, the very best things. And I think even the critics can't help you do that anymore because they can't. They don't have a consensus about uh-huh. around what it is. And I feel that ultimately the net effect is that, you know, the consumers love television, and I know this is heretical to say this, but they love it a little bit less because there's too much of it.
So here's the courage of your convictions question. When are you going to start canceling or not putting shows on to get your really great stuff out there and take the lead in this?
Well, we do cancel shows. We cancel really good shows. We canceled a show called Married that is a really good show, and there are many people that really love it. And
yeah, but we're talking about great here, John, not really good.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You know, you said courage of our convictions. Yeah. The answer is you got to cancel a good show so that you can try to make a great show. But on the other hand, we have a great show on the air right now called Fargo. Fargo mm-hmm. season one mm-hmm. was the most critically acclaimed television show in America last year. The second cycle, which is currently on the air, has been widely judged by critics to be better than the first cycle. And yet the audience for it is a little bit down.
So what do you do with that? How do those meetings go on Monday mornings when you guys look over the numbers and go,
We live in the courage of our convictions, which is to say, what can we do other than make shows that are great? And ultimately, I believe that Fargo will be watched, you know, a great deal over the next 10 years because it's just that good. But the reality is that in this moment in time, this show, which will probably once again be the most critically acclaimed show in America, is getting drowned out by a lot of other shows that are good or some of them mediocre because essentially there's too much television.
How much of the subtext of this idea, this thought that you have about too much TV is rooted in it being simply harder for you and everybody else in this business to find audiences?
It is somewhat rooted in that because if you accept the premise that television is a mass medium, ultimately you have to be able to aggregate a mass audience. And so too many shows, too many new entrants creates a bubble. And ultimately what happens to bubbles is, you know, they deflate eventually and you come back to some kind of more sustainable business model with a sustainable number of series. But back to the premise of your question, there's no question that I and everyone else who's marketing television is having more and more difficulty getting your attention because there's so many shows clamoring for your attention.
John Landgraf, the CEO of FX. We'll call you back in a year, John. We'll figure out if your theory was right, all right?
Okay.
All right, be good.
Good to
Thanks.
Talk to you, Kai.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
This final note on the way out today, see if you can spot the fatal business model flaw in what I'm about to tell you. From the Washington Post, this item, a new coffee shop opened up in Manhattan last Friday. It's the Swiss Water Decaffeinated Coffee Company, serving, yes, only decaf. Here's a hint, that right there, that was the fatal flaw. To be fair, it's just a pop-up, only going to be open for a week, because, yeah.
All
On a Monday in early November, Wall Street broke out like this. The Dow up 165 points, about 0.9%. The Nasdaq up 73 points, 1.4%. The S&P 500 gained 24 points, 1.2%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.